Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Prices start at $9 per month. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH. For more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can say that I get a lot of value out of them. Merck Research is different from other research, which usually just cherry picks all positive or all negative charts and then falls into the trap of confirmation bias. Merck Research provides an intellectually consistent approach by going through a consistent set of relevant data and then putting it through a consistent set of frameworks, which is then summarized in a checklist and in a concise written summary. Their monthly economic and market data review provides an excellent overview of the macro landscape. It's all compiled in one place and easy to interpret chart books with written analysis. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer and get a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com/contrarian. That's Merck spelled M-E-R-K. Or you can log on to merckresearch.com. Sign up for a regular subscription and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this free offer. Now, on to today's episode.
Cryptocurrencies. This is something that I have avoided speaking about and focusing on in the 2+ years that I've had this podcast, despite repeated attempts by various people to get me to cover it. And the reason for that is that there's really only two ways historically that conversation about cryptocurrencies could go. Number one, that these were the greatest thing since sliced bread and we're going to usher in peace on earth and brotherhood among mankind. Or two, they were a complete scam to enable criminality and were not worth the algorithms they were printed on, even though algorithms don't print, but whatever. And so I historically have avoided them for this reason. I didn't want to come in on one side or the other or have the guests speak about one side or the other. But my guest today, Jacob Ma Weaver of Cable Car Capital, has a unique viewpoint on cryptos. And that's the one thing. I'll get to that in a minute. But also, this is extremely timely. As we record this here on Wednesday, May 19th, cryptocurrencies and have been taken out back and beaten to a pulp. I think they are down about 20% from their highs. Just today, Bitcoin itself was down about 10%. And it's just the question of not only when the bleeding will stop, but if it'll stop. And this is all precipitated by what we're going to talk about, actually, which is the regulatory risk for cryptos, especially here in the US. I say that because what precipitated this most recent drop in cryptos today and last night was the PBOC, the Central Bank of China, stepping in and coming in with some regulation that has hurt these assets. Anyway, that long intro out of the side, I am now very pleased to welcome Jacob to the podcast. And maybe let's start with the most recent news here. What do you think of the PBOC's move here today?
Well, thank you for having me, Nathaniel. And let me just say off the bat that, you know, I tend to skew a little bit towards that second bias you referenced. And I'm going to do my best here to be balanced and not just call crypto an outright scam.
Okay.
But, you know, where I'm coming from, so your listeners know, is first of all, I'm not an attorney nor an investor in crypto, but I am going to express some opinions on both legal topics and topics that are of interest to people who do invest in those markets. Of course, everything I say is not financial advice in any way. And if I were to give financial advice, it would probably be not to invest in cryptocurrency.
Okay.
But with that bias disclosed, you know, my focus and reason for spending time on this over the years has been a deep interest in investor protection issues. And we may talk later, if there's time, a little bit about my fund and what I do, but I am primarily focused on long and short investments in public companies, many of which touch on cryptocurrency, and it's been important in studying microcap fraud and retail investment schemes and things of the like, to learn a lot about this emerging area of technology and investment. So that's the perspective I come to it from. And with that in mind, I was very pleased to see the news coming out of mm-hmm. China. I don't think it's very likely we'll see something of the same order of magnitude here in the US. We'll obviously get to some of those details later, but I think that it was likely the right thing to do.
Hmm. Interesting. And I forgot to mention at the outset that you have been in touch with regulators. We don't want to say who or which ones or in what capacity, but you have been having conversations around crypto regulation with some regulatory folks here in the US, right?
Yes. And so my perspective is informed both by private conversations with enforcement staff, as well as some public commentary that for those who are interested, you can see my public comments on, for example, the CFTC had a rulemaking process a few years back regarding actual delivery in the context of commodities that are financed, which is a topic very relevant to exchange regulation.
Hmm. Maybe let's start a little bit on your background, which we usually leave for later, but I think to put it into context, where does your interest in cryptos come from and what has kind of informed it over the years?
Yeah, so as mentioned, I manage a long-short equity strategy. It's primarily equity-focused. I do some things in other parts of the capital structure through a fund called the Funicular Fund. And as you know, of course, we were initially introduced by a mutual friend who I think had the idea that I could come on your podcast and talk up my investment business. I didn't want to do another stock pitch episode, and I'm glad we have something more timely to talk about. But my business primarily is around, on the short side, looking for wrongdoing in the capital markets. And that's alongside a much longer term, long time horizon investment portfolio on the long side, which frees up a lot of time and attention to go out and see if there's some way I can be on the other side of stock promotion, fraud, market manipulation, and ultimately try to do something about that. That's where I found a lot of meaning in the work. Despite the challenges of short selling, it's meant that I could have productive conversations with regulators and members of the public and really try to, where possible at least, affect some change. So some of that is, publishing research, which I've done in the past. Some of it is more behind the scenes. But I initially got interested in exchanges and the topic of, sort of the business of public markets through a long investment in Intercontinental Exchange at this point now 7 years ago. And it was through my research on that I came across some less reputable exchanges that we're offering financial products primarily to retail speculators. And I had a published short report on a company called Plus 500, which sells contracts for difference. There's a gambling instrument, basically a swap that's legal in Europe. And that experience led me down a really long rabbit hole that's led to this conversation today. We're basically, over the last 5 or 6 years, I've spent a lot of time digging into that industry. So alongside CFD brokers like Plus 500 that are publicly traded, there was a darker industry of unregulated broker dealers that sold a related financial product called a binary option. Mm-hmm. And that's been a major enforcement focus for the SEC. It was outlawed in Israel, where a number of the operators were based. And as you can likely guess, a number of the people involved in that business, after previously selling CFDs or binary options or leveraged Forex, pivoted quite naturally to cryptocurrencies. And I see many of the same techniques in terms of marketing, customer acquisition, the functionality of the exchanges themselves present in cryptocurrency exchanges. And I view it as one long continuum of sort of wrongdoing, obviously to varying degrees. Mm. And it's prompted a lot of my research efforts in that space.
Nice. So your interest in this comes from an activist, what sounds like an activist short angle. We've had activist short sellers on the podcast before, but I'm actually glad that we're not talking about stocks, specific stocks here, because it's always a bit of a legal minefield.
Absolutely. Yeah.
More for you than for me, but for me as well. But okay, so crypto exchanges, now how are they currently regulated, if at all, here in the US?
Well, I think that's going to be one of the biggest areas of potential enforcement, quite frankly, because I see there being a very clear-cut definition of what type of exchange is required to register with the regulatory authorities. And what's so remarkable in the space is that a lot of the major players that are household names have not done so. To be clear, that there are some carve-outs that appear to be possible for an exchange to operate legitimately without any federal oversight, with the exception of registration as a money services business. So as a first point, if you are just selling Bitcoin or a similar commodity cryptocurrency for cash, you are more or less entitled to do that by simply registering as a money services business, also known as a money transmitter, with the various states. And FinCEN at the federal level oversees that process. And the goal is basically just to make sure that people are not engaging in money laundering activity. And so the rules that apply to that are really geared towards that and not any of the things that we have come to associate with broker-dealer or exchange supervision in the US, like best execution, custody requirements, various other regulations that are really geared towards protecting small retail investors who want to trade in stocks and other derivatives.
Okay, so the crypto exchanges are registered as these money transfer agents, or what are they called?
Money services businesses.
Is there a limit, like a certain type of notional value that you process and trades that you process a day, where you have to go to FINRA or something, or how does that work?
Well, so it's state by state, bit of a patchwork of regulations, but generally speaking, if you're handling customer funds to buy and sell commodities, you need to have this registration. But it's a pretty low bar. It's a notice filing and then some reporting requirements. You're supposed to report suspicious transactions. But it's not the full-fledged suite of brokerage oversight that I think you may be thinking of.
Yeah.
But that is actually the key sort of thing that I've found so surprising about the space is there is, of course, a regulated framework for registering either a broker-dealer or the commodity side is called a futures commission merchant. And that really is the thing that a lot of exchanges have ignored because it wasn't convenient for them, because they couldn't comply with all of the regulations that apply to those businesses. So broadly, if you trade securities, and I realize there's some debate over what exactly in crypto may be a security, then you need to have a broker-dealer registration, and that's where FINRA or the SEC, or actually a combination of the two, would have some oversight over your activities.
Okay, so, but FINRA, so the rule says FINRA is for buying and selling of securities. And how does it define that? Do you know offhand? Because it seems like that's the question, is that these cryptos claim that they are digital assets, which for whatever reason is not a security. So yeah. What is the, yeah, how does that get resolved?
Well, so we should come back to the question of what is or isn't a security, because yeah. I think the perception that there's uncertainty there is a little bit of a self-serving idea that's been misstated in the market. But given that you have any securities transacting on your platform, then it's very straightforward. Like the definition of a broker and the definition of a dealer are found in Section 5 of the Securities Act. And it's pretty straightforward. I mean, if you either acting as a principal or as an agent facilitate transactions in those instruments, then you are required to register, full stop.
Okay. In what instruments?
Sorry, securities.
So, in securities. But how do they define securities? Like, what is it like?
Well, so then we get to that question. What is a security? And yeah. I think the definition is quite broad. You know, it includes all the instruments that you would already, you know, self-evidently expect, like a stock. Sure. But what usually ends up being the point of contention is it also includes a category called an investment contract. Uh-huh. And an investment contract is really a catch-all that through case law and importantly a Supreme Court case that's often referred to in the context of the Howey test, basically has come to mean any investment of money in a collective common enterprise where there's an expectation of profit. Uh-huh. And so that can refer to a lot of different things, yes. But substance is more important than form.
Well, for somebody who's not a lawyer, you pretty much put that into context pretty well, I must say, and show quite a bit of knowledge of the statutes from what it sounds like. And it also sounds like there is absolutely no reason why digital currencies shouldn't be included in this, right?
Well, I think that's the key point. You know, the SEC looked into Ethereum when they issued the report in 2017 called the Report on the DAO. And they basically walked through that analysis and relied heavily on the Howey test and sort of introduced that to the public as a way to provide guidance. And, you know, sometimes regulatory authorities are criticized for regulating solely by enforcement, but this was the commission coming out and saying, you know, here's what we think. And a lot of these offerings that we're seeing in the marketplace look a lot like securities. And oh, by the way, this very well-known one was in fact a security, but it's been long enough. People maybe didn't understand. They were well-intentioned. So we're going to exercise our forbearance and not prosecute them. But if you do something similar, you know, you're on notice that that may be a securities offering and you should register it. And so what's so remarkable about that piece of history, and in my view, incredibly self-serving, was almost immediately afterwards, you had law firms come out and, in my opinion, deliberately throw sand in the air to try to muddy the waters and scream regulatory uncertainty. There was a white paper, of course it was a white paper, issued by the law firm Cooley, where they introduced the concept of a SAFT, which was the Simple Agreement for Future Tokens. And they basically had this idea that, you know, if you do a securities offering that's a private sale in the SAFT, that investment into an actual security could later convert into something that was a commodity cryptocurrency, which would not be a security and therefore not subject to the securities laws.
Oh.
And that was a very clever workaround. It relied very heavily on one particular interpretation of a Supreme Court precedent that, frankly, a lot of attorneys take issue with. But, you know, it was out there and companies relied on it. But at the end of the day, the determination of whether that newly created currency was a commodity or not depended a lot on whether there was any actual use value at the end of the day. And I think we saw a lot of maybe not so well-meaning projects come out and try to rely on that loophole and raise money without having a truly consumptive commodity in question. And I guess just for the sort of detail-minded folks in the weeds who enjoy this sort of thing, the specific case that I think was inapposite reliance, and again, not an attorney, but I sort of enjoy geeking out over this stuff too, was a case called Foreman, where the Supreme Court looked at a housing cooperative where the investors or really purchasers in that housing cooperative were buying homes to live in. And when they were asked to consider whether that purchase was an investment contract or not, the court made a comment that, you know, if you buy a house solely to live in, then clearly that's not a securities investment at all. Like, it's not an expectation of profit. You're buying your residence. But if there's some combination of the two, maybe some utility and maybe some investment purpose, then you have to look at a fact-based analysis and it gets a bit more up in the air. And that's really, I think, the genesis of this idea that has taken on a life of its own, that like a cryptocurrency might not be a security if people just could use it enough.
Well, that's a good one, because what exactly do they use this for other than speculation and maybe paying off criminality? Like, right? Like,
well, and as we saw this week, you can't even buy a pizza with it.
Right. You can't? I thought you could.
There was some the Bitcoin pizza idea that only took credit cards. So it was sort of an amusing meme.
Okay. So this all begs the question, why haven't any of these regulatory agencies, be it FINRA, the SEC, the CFTC, stepped in and tried to do more to regulate cryptocurrency trading?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. But I have two entirely opposite responses to that. I guess the first one is that they have.
Okay.
I think it's underappreciated the extent to which the SEC has acted relative to its normal kind of pace and ability. So I'm not sure most people realize, but there have been 75, I believe, was the most recent number I saw, cryptocurrency-related enforcement actions in the last, I think, 3 years,
okay.
Which is a huge number. I mean, a lot of those are relatively small-bore offenses, but that is part of their broader enforcement strategy. You know, they tend to go after low-hanging fruit and have a few marquee cases that really try to establish the deterrent value and make clear what the limits of acceptable behavior are. But that's all happened in an incredibly short period of time when you consider that their statutory enforcement period is 5 years. And so a lot of the behavior in 2017, you know, still has not been adjudicated. And there were headlines, I think a year or two ago, that something on the order of 300 open investigations were underway within the space alone. And, you know, it's hard to validate that number from the outside, but I would say that they have been very responsive to hearing from the public. And I think that when you think about the sheer number of unregistered offerings that took place, and ultimately, I think most ICOs were in fact unregistered securities offerings, they are not going to get everyone. It's more just a question of which moles get whacked, if I can torture the metaphor a bit. Like, at the end of the day, they will bring a lot of enforcement actions, but some people will get away. And so there's maybe like a larger political question of whether that's the right approach or if it's sufficient to protect investors. But within the context of how they typically operate, I think it's been relatively robust. The CFTC has also contributed to some of that, although I guess from my perspective, they've been a bit less active. Mm. I think that's been partly due to transitions at the senior level in the commission and also just the limited resources that they have, again, on a relative basis. But what I personally have found surprising, I suppose, is that they haven't generally taken the, in my view, obvious step of having established that certain assets are securities and then sanctioning the issuers of those securities, taking the next step and sanctioning the second order players in those securities. So, for example, they charged and then ultimately won a case against KIC, which was the issuer of a digital token called KIN. And there were exchanges that sold that token. There were venture capital investors who may have statutory underwriter liability as resellers of that token. And none of those entities have been charged. By the same token, pun intended, you have other sort of widely acknowledged securities that were widely traded on platforms that are not registered as broker dealers. And so I think to the extent you accept that those were in fact securities, I think it's a really interesting question. Well, why haven't they charged the exchanges? I don't know the answer to that. I think it's a mix of regulatory priority and, may at the end of the day also be a political question to some extent.
Right. And that is the type of thing where one would think with a Republican administration is typically a little more hands-off when it comes to regulation, and maybe a Democratic administration a little more hands-on. So perhaps now with this transition that we've just had in D.C., things could be changing. Is that a possibility, you think?
I do think that's a possibility. I mean, I find it a little bit ironic that a lot of fans of crypto were excited about Gensler's confirmation because he taught a class on blockchain at MIT. But I think when you look at his public comments, he's evinced a lot of concern for investor protection issues. And, I will say that Jay Clayton was significantly more active than a lot of people expected for a Trump nominee. But it's anyone's guess how all this will play out. Mm. I mean, I think to name a couple of specific names, I mean, you have seen very public statements from one of the SEC commissioners, Hester Peirce, that sort of are in favor of financial innovation and towards a less heavy-handed enforcement regime. Similarly, there was a statement, sort of a concurrence in a recent CFTC enforcement action against Coinbase, where Don Stump, who was another Trump appointee, basically made the point that while she didn't necessarily have any problem with the specific enforcement action that was taken, which was a slap on the wrist for some market manipulation Coinbase engaged in a number of years ago, she didn't think that the CFTC had any business regulating cryptocurrency exchanges at all. Mm. And then it's one of those things where, if a majority of the commissioners don't want to take a course of action, actually, it doesn't matter what the law states in that regard. They won't do it. Mm.
Yeah, no doubt. Is there, does crypto, to your knowledge, have a big lobbying presence in DC yet?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because it's been reported just in the last few weeks that has become a much more salient feature. And I think even a few years back, some of these investors made so much money that they could devote attention and resources to creating foundations and lobbying arms that, whether they used to not so much specifically lobby Congress in a disclosed way, but they would push for like the Wyoming legislature has passed a number of blockchain related bills that try to encourage companies to locate there. And there have been some very public efforts to try to push back on specific enforcement cases. Right. So Kik, as an example, had a almost a GoFundMe of sorts from members of the community that, you know, it went to its legal defense fees. And Ripple, which is another arguably and allegedly securities offering that's currently in litigation with the SEC, has hired Mary Jo White as defense counsel. She's formerly of the SEC, and very publicly stated that, you know, they don't think their offering was a security, which obviously I disagree with quite strongly, but that there's a bit of a, ironically, David versus Goliath dynamic, where I think the Goliath is the crypto industry to some extent. And the reason I say that is that, you know, people who are ordinary market participants or investors like myself who may have our biases, you know, I don't have the war chest that Coinbase does to lobby for change. And Brian Armstrong was quite public just this week, posting pictures with Nancy Pelosi and talking about how he just spent a week in Washington trying to socialize his views of what cryptocurrency regulation should be. And I don't know what those views are, but I'm fairly certain they don't involve heavier regulation of his business, except insofar as Coinbase would actually be a beneficiary of regulating out of existence some of the more marginal players.
That's true also. All right, we're overdue for a break, but I want to ask you one last thing before we do take a break, which is, what do you make of the argument that regulatory bodies effectively can't shut down crypto trading if they wanted to? You hear that a lot, like with this, you know, with India, for example. There's been a couple news reports over the last year or two that India is going to stop allowing crypto exchanges and people, or crypto trading. And people say, well, you can't do it. You can't stop it. There's no way. What do you make of that? And it sounds like, I think I know your answer, but yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, I find it amusing because I think governments have as much power as we decide to give them as a citizenry. So, you know, you can
sometimes
debate
more, it, but you go on, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's a social contract, right? And at the end of the day, a government could impose a 100% tax on profits from cryptocurrency, you know, if they chose to do that. I don't necessarily think that's going to happen, or that, you know, an outright ban is likely. Whether it would be technologically easy or difficult to enforce isn't really the point, I think. So people maybe take that line of argumentation a bit too far, I think.
Yeah, it seems like that's a common theme, taking the argument a little bit too far when it comes to this particular asset class. All right, Jacob Ma Weaver, I want to come back and I want to ask you about what you think may be coming specifically in terms of regulation in the US for these cryptocurrencies. But let's first take a short break to hear from our sponsors. Real quick though, if you are a premium subscriber, don't touch the dial, don't go anywhere, because you will not get the break. And to become a premium subscriber, head to the website contrarian.supercast.tech, T-E-C-H, and sign up.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host and access to private channels on our Discord server. They also get generous discounts to our virtual conferences and other services. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information. That's contrarian.supercast.tech.
I need to tell you about Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can absolutely recommend them. Their research is different. They do not cherry pick positive or negative charts, nor do they fall into the trap of confirmation bias. They have an intellectually consistent approach. They grew through a consistent set of relevant data, put them through the same consistent set of frameworks, and then summarize the whole thing in a checklist with a concise written summary. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer, which is a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com, sign up for one of the subscriptions, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this limited offer. That's merckresearch.com, M-E-R-K.
Welcome back, everybody. Jacob Ma Weaver here from Cable Car Capital. Fascinating discussion on cryptocurrencies. We touched on your background at the outset a little bit, but this is the segment of the show where our guest gives us a little bit more of his or her origin story, to put things into Marvel terms, and just talk about how they came to the world of investing and their current station in life. So curious about your story.
Yeah, well, definitely not a superhero of the like, but I've been managing Cable Car for now almost 8 years. It's sort of hard to believe. I started it when I was 26 years old, fresh off a stint at Amici Capital, which was hedge fund better known as Porter Orlin, one of the original A.W. Jones model long-short strategies in operation since the 70s. Before that, worked at Dodge & Cox, a big long-only shop here in San Francisco, and McKinsey straight out of college. You know, what can I say? I've been in San Francisco the last 11 years, was in New York before that, went to school at Columbia. And for me, investing has always been one of those just perfect seat on the world type of careers. And it appealed to me because I had very broad interests that I could never quite narrow down. I was a comparative literature major in undergrad and then did a master's in statistics. Mm. So one for love and one for money. I always like to joke, but you know, not always the one you would think. I think the job really requires a lot of close reading, and statistics is more about a philosophical way of thinking about the world probabilistically and thinking about investment outcomes in the same light. So, you know, what I do today is I could style it a little bit like a family office, just without the capital base. You know, I launched Cable Car as a RIA initially, was managing separate accounts, rolled that into a pooled vehicle in 2018, and today we run about $25 million. Obviously trying to grow that like every manager, but you know, at my current size, it's an interesting inflection point where I am running one of the smallest multi-prime and multi-strategy funds that's really out there. You know, I do a lot of work in hard to borrow short selling, focused on some of the investor protection issues I mentioned earlier, and that requires a lot of deep understanding of stock loan and corporate action dynamics and working with different brokers on that kind of thing, alongside, as mentioned, a more long-term oriented long book, which I think the main feature there is I'm looking for asymmetric risk return and trying to find opportunities to own securities that have downside protection as sort of my first and foremost criterion, and then I can take more concentrated positions where I think there's some potential return that's being underappreciated by the market.
All right. How is San Francisco right now? Is it coming back now from COVID? Because New York kind of is, but yeah.
Yeah, noticeably. I have a two-year-old at home, so I can't say I get out as much as I may be used to, but you know, I think people are really welcoming the opportunity to go back to restaurants, and I think it may be a little longer before retail comes back. There are a lot of store closures and things that are really unfortunate, and I think it'll be hard to come back from. But certainly restaurants have had a noticeable uptick and traffic as well.
Hmm. Interesting. All right, cool. So let's talk a little more granularly now about the risk for cryptos that you see. And like I said, we saw it today with the PBOC. And this is not the first time the PBOC has acted against cryptos, by the way. Back in, I think it might have been 2017, the last time that these, you know, experienced a boom. And I was in the region at the time. They came down and cracked down on a bunch of them. And it caused a huge plunge in Bitcoin, well into the single digits, if memory serves. But that's just the PBOC. So you know, none of us really have any knowledge about that, but we do, or at least you do, have a little more knowledge of the situation here in the US. So what do you see coming down the pike?
Yeah, well, I think anytime I'm making predictions, you know, obvious disclaimers apply. I don't know. And as much as my bias would be that I'd like to see some broad market clearing event where there's instant regulatory clarity and, you know, some sort of holding to account of bad actors, you know, those types of events are quite rare and I think not the most likely scenario.
Now, hang on a second. Let me just ask you about this because on that, they are quite rare, but they do happen periodically. And if you go back to, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley in the early 2000s, Dodd-Frank, you know, which greatly regulated banks and broker-dealers and a bunch of stuff, all of these things are precipitated by crises of some sort, which and more specifically, a huge sell-off in the assets in question. We may be starting that here. We're already looking at a 20% correction. Can you see that being the thing that precipitates this?
So, yes, I mean, I would qualify any prediction with if there's some sort of mass loss event that takes place, particularly among retail investors, where, you know, that's where back to the political question, if people lose a lot of money and ordinary folks are harmed on a scale that prompts collective action, then I think you will see it. There are obviously risks that exist within crypto and that could lead to that sort of thing. But, you know, your guess is as good as mine if it will ever actually happen. And I think probably the prime example of that would be something like Tether, if that were to collapse. Or quite frankly, that's where regulation could come into play. If there were an enforcement action of some sort that were to prevent Tether from continuing to be used in the way it is now as an on-ramp and off-ramp to many of the less legitimate unregistered exchanges that exist and provide services to the industry, you know, that is the sort of watershed event that I think could potentially precipitate some form of Dodd-Frank or similar regulatory response. But barring that, what do I think will actually happen? There are a few things I think we can point to, and I've sort of already alluded to some of them. There will be more ICO and related enforcement actions. I don't know how many, I don't know which, not sure what timetable either, but they've been slowly trickling out, and I think I have not seen any indication that the SEC in particular is done with that. And there's certainly a number of projects out there that have legal exposure. I also think that there will continue to be a wave of private litigation, whether the SEC does something or not. Our securities laws are quite robust to that, and you've already seen a number of class actions. And my firm is actually involved in funding an ICO case and would fund more if, you know, the need arose. I think there's always a limitation there where, you know, if attorneys are willing to take that risk on their own, they don't necessarily need outside capital. They can work on contingency, but sometimes you have a group of plaintiffs for whom that makes sense. And I guess my door is always open as far as that goes. But, you know, the other way in which I think regulators will act is the exchanges. So, you know, there is a need for just for basic investor protection reasons for exchanges that allow people to speculate in the way people do in the stock market to have some oversight, and MSB registration doesn't cut it. So you've already seen Coinbase, for example, has purchased a broker-dealer license. For whatever reason, they're not currently running all of their altcoin transactions through that subsidiary. That would be a question for their attorneys, but, you know, would seem like at some point they might be moving in the direction of operating either an ATS, which is a SEC-approved exchange alternative transaction system, or registering as a broker-dealer. I think that other exchanges may also need to register with the CFTC. As mentioned, the finance retail purchase of commodities if you're offering margin trading to US persons, arguably there was some regulatory uncertainty 3 or 4 years ago about that, but Poloniex actually submitted a rulemaking petition, and that's the one I referenced commenting on earlier. The CFTC had previously brought an enforcement action against Bitfinex for failing to register, and then they put out a rulemaking to make it doubly clear. And they finalized that now a year ago, saying, yeah, you know, you need to register. And they recite regularly in their enforcement actions, registration is the kingpin of the statutory machinery. And I think it's a great point, which is really that if you're not registered with an oversight body, they can't very effectively regulate you. You know, the only way they can regulate you is through enforcement. And so I think registration is really essential. And along the same lines, registration of a prospectus is really important in an offering. You know, like it or not, we live in a disclosure-based regime, not one that's qualification-based. So as long as you disclose the risk, you are basically allowed to sell things to the public, as long as you're not committing fraud. There's no body that approves or disproves your prospectus as being good enough. And I think for companies looking to raise capital to ignore that is really, you know, very disappointing and frankly, a sign of the times. And, you know, cryptocurrency is just one example of it, but it's one of those things that gets very easily enforced against. So, you know, we will see more registered offerings that touch on blockchain in some way if people genuinely have demand to invest in these assets. Hmm. So by the same, I already said by the same token, but...
Yeah, that's all right. It's a good one. We can keep using it.
Yeah, I'll reuse that. That's going to mean that projects that don't comply with those, again, fairly straightforward and I think not that limiting requirements. You know, people do private placements and Reg D offerings and, you know, crowdfunded offerings where they make various disclosures or limit their offering to accredited investors all the time. It's not hard to raise money that way. And I think for companies in a self-serving way to argue that they don't have to comply with the existing regulation, that's going to continue to be a focus. Mm. So you'll see more of that. And then more specifically, you know, anything that's sort of an obvious flaw, like, for example, the SEC and CFTC jointly brought a case against a company called Abra a year or so ago for selling security-based swaps. They were basically tokenizing equities on the blockchain. And you can't do that without having a prospectus. And, you know, if Tesla or Apple or whichever company needs to file a prospectus to sell their stock, you need to file a prospectus to sell a derivative on that stock. And, right. You know, unless there's a qualified exemption. So bottom line is I think we'll see enforcement actions against exchanges, against ICO issuers, against, you know, obvious violations like that. And the open question is how far the regulatory authorities will go into some of these newer, you know, more, I guess, harder to characterize new innovations in the space. So, you know, will a stablecoin be considered a security? That's a topic of some debate right now. I think you can guess what my perspective would be and is. But, you know, will a DeFi platform where, you know, there may be some central bodies that act in certain ways to control it, but otherwise responsibility is spread out among different actors. Which of those actors will ultimately be held to account and how will enforcement authorities prioritize that? I think there's a great deal of uncertainty with respect to that right now.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
Here's a question for you. What about, there are several publicly traded companies that are kind of like derivatives of crypto, if you will, and they've kind of served as like these whatever they with gateways for crypto, you know, over the last year or two. Coinbase is the most recent one that went public. If you're a short seller, would you think that these companies, these stocks, are at risk if there is more regulation?
Yeah, I mean, speaking from my own point of view, my decision whether to buy or sell any of those individual companies would have more to do with their specific circumstances rather than like a broad bet on the sector. But certainly there's an argument to be made that the stocks will trade in some correlation to broader views of the space. I don't know that it's necessarily a first order effect. Like Coinbase, again, leaving aside whatever its merits and valuation may be, if you were considering that solely as an exchange, I could make an argument from the Intercontinental experience that like, actually, it should be correlated to volatility in crypto as opposed, or trading activity even, as opposed to price. So sort of the first derivative, because, you know, that's what would drive, greater trading on the platform and spreads and profitability. But, you know, it's not that simple. So I think when it comes to less widely known securities, kind of pump and dump schemes that have tried to piggyback on activity in the space, that's where you might almost expect to see a closer correlation. Thinking back to 2017, you know, when you had the wave of companies that changed their name and, you know, Long Island Iced Tea famously became Long Blockchain, those types of movements, or Kodak, you know, getting a brief premium due to its association with the space. These are the types of things that are much more short-lived and definitely correlated with mania in the sector. Mm.
I wonder if some of this stuff, you know, whatever utility that, you know, these cryptos have, as you have more regulation, if that kind of removes it. But who knows? I mean, already you're taxed on these things. So it's not like, at least in the US, so it's not like, you know, it's any kind of loophole there.
Well, I'll jump in there for a moment. I know one friend of mine who's a crypto investor will be listening, and so this shout out to him. We just spoke yesterday, but you know, I think to say something positive about crypto, I think that to the extent blockchain technology or distributed ledger technology has practical applications, investors in the space should really welcome more aggressive regulation of financial promotions in the space. You know, anytime there's excitement about a new technology, you see a lot of capital flow to it. And that, of course, attracts bad actors and people looking to separate fools from their money. But, you know, this much capital doesn't flow to something without at least some promise. And I'm not the one to comment on what exactly that might be, but, you know, if it's there, it will come to light and the cream will rise to the top, as it were. And so I think that ultimately less, you know, speculation and what's ultimately socially harmful in the form of gambling activity, in my opinion, would be a good thing for the legitimate projects that remain.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, dot-coms in the late 90s, those companies, with a few exceptions, are all long gone, right? And it took a while for the world to kind of harness the internet and figure out, and with advances in technology too, and obviously broadband and such, to kind of put it to use in a real business perspective. So there is that. But as far as the currency aspect of it is, here's a question for you. We're recording this in 2021. 10 years from now, 2031, will crypto still be a thing?
I personally don't think it'll be a thing. Mm. Not in its current form. I do think something distributed ledger related might have technological applications that could still be in use. I don't think there will be widespread acceptance of a non-government-backed digital currency, you know, for all the sort of reasons that we've been discussing from a regulatory standpoint, but ultimately, in part, because of the current fragility of the system and the way it's been set up. But that's not to say that the underlying technology couldn't be used for a socially useful purpose. Perfectly happy to be proven wrong on that too. Right? You know, it's again important to emphasize that I'm not allocating capital to this view so much as, you know, using it to inform my understanding of publicly traded securities and trying to work with regulators where I can to make a bit of a difference in some of the things I see as being risks to investors. Mm.
See, now you're sounding like an economist. Well, on the one hand, rates could go up. On the other hand, they could go down. No, I'm kidding. But anyway.
Market calls, yeah.
Yeah, no, I get it. Jacob Ma Weaver, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast. Before we close, maybe you could tell our listeners how they can find out more about you, how to get in touch. I don't think you have a social media presence, but maybe you do. And we'll put this in the show notes as well, but go ahead.
Yeah, appreciate it. I have a website under construction, but you know it's a privately marketed fund, so best way to find me probably is on social media. I do have a somewhat active Twitter account.
Oh, okay.
With apologies for that. It's Cable Car Capital.
Cable Car Capital. Okay, one word. Where does this the cable car thing come from? Maybe because you're in San Francisco,
Yeah, San Francisco. I was surprised it wasn't taken. A lot of people name their funds after geographic landmarks, they liked the up and down metaphor for long short equity.
Mm.
And as I do occasional transactions in the fixed income space, people sometimes point out that CCC isn't the best abbreviation. But
that's right.
I nevertheless did like the name, and we manage the funicular fund.
That's right. Yeah, that's hilarious. Yeah. So, what's your second fund going to be? The Andela Fund? No, that's a different thing.
That's a good question. I don't know. I did have a SPV engaged in some litigation efforts called Kakapo, which was named after the flightless parrot. Popular on Last Chance to See. Stephen Fry had a funny segment on it, but that was an analogy to kind of harmed investors who maybe would not have any other recourse. The Kakapo is nearly extinct, and in New Zealand it's sort of a passion project for local conservationists. Keep this dumb bird alive.
Interesting. Very cool. Very cool. All right, Jacob, thank you so much for joining the podcast. And we look forward to speaking to you all again next time.
Nathaniel, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.